welcome to this week's podcast with me, Laura Merrilees and Ellie Gelder. Today we're joined by Darren Newman, leading employment law expert and consultant editor for Expert HR, for a roundtable discussion on some of the main employment law changes and trends that we can expect to see coming through in the next few months and beyond. We'll be taking a look at how these impact on HR practice and what you can do practically to get ahead of these changes and associated risks. Darren, if I may, can we kick off briefly with Brexit? Given that so much is still unknown and in fact broadly remains unchanged for HR since we recorded our Brexit webinar last year, I don't think it's something that we particularly need to dwell on today, other than perhaps to remind listeners of the ongoing discrimination risk they face if recruitment and employment decisions are based on nationality.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to remember that although we're talking about Brexit all the time, we haven't Brexited.
No.
We're still very much members of the European Union, and all our discrimination law applies as normal. What an employer absolutely mustn't do is assume that because there may be a change in immigration law in the offing, and we don't know whether there will or won't, that when they're dealing with somebody whose position post-Brexit may be less clear, that's not something that they can take into account in making recruitment decisions or promotion decisions or anything else to do with management, really. What we've got to remember is race is a protected characteristic, nationality is part of that protected characteristic, and as long as people have permission to work in the UK, which they do currently, then that's something that they're completely protected for.
So nothing changes on that front, and people just need to be mindful of that.
We generally think that employment law won't be massively affected by Brexit, at least in the short term anyway. What I'm waiting to see is this great repeal bill. I hope it's not called that, but the great repeal bill, which will clarify exactly what the status of various bits of European law will be once we pass that threshold.
Yeah, well, once we see it, we'll obviously be updating listeners on, you know, how that might impact. So we'll keep an eye out for it.
Just putting Brexit aside for now.
No, let's just keep talking about Brexit.
Can we move on to, I think it's fair to say, Darren, one of the most talked about changes in employment law, gender pay gap reporting. It's certainly got a lot of people talking. And that's the requirement with employers with 250 or more employees to report differences in pay of their male and female employees. And that would include bonus pay as well.
Yeah.
And the Equality Act 2010, Gender Pay Gap Regulations 2017, to give them their full name.
And we should always give them their full name. You should say that every time you say gender pay gap.
They've now been finalised, and so relevant employers, if they haven't already done so, will be starting to put that information together. We won't go into detail here as we've got a webinar on it, but there are a few themes that we know people are struggling with. So just first off, can we just talk about briefly the position where an employer's got workers overseas and how that feeds into who they're including for their calculations?
Okay, well, hopefully we can be quite reassuring about this, because when you look at the gender pay gap regulations, they can seem very complicated. They are very complicated. They're massively overcomplicated. There's just no justification for the level of complexity that those regulations have.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is this isn't like, say, working time or working out someone's holiday entitlement, where the precise details of what you decide to do will affect someone's monetary entitlement, and therefore that can lead to a court case.
And it will be looked at by a tribunal.
So it's a lot of these questions are never going to get litigated. There are gaps in what we can figure out from these regulations, and I think overseas workers is one of them. I think off the top of my head, I'd say what the regulations concentrate on is who your employee is, and it doesn't say where your employee is. If you're an employer in the UK and you as a legal entity employ someone who happens to work in Dubai or Spain or Brazil, and there isn't an intermediary company that employs them in their host country, then technically I suppose they're included. But I doubt it's going to matter very much. I doubt that there's going to be so many people employed overseas that it will affect the overall average. And remember, all that gets published is the gender pay gap information. You don't have to publish your working out. You don't have to show exactly who you've included and who you haven't. And I don't see any circumstance in which that can be raised as a legal claim. So I don't think we'll ever get a clear answer.
If it would distort the information that you're putting out there, then that might be...
I think that's fair enough. And I'd say, look at the information that you've got. And if there is an anomaly in terms of where people are that you're unsure about, I would err on the side of picking the answer that seems most representative, that seems to give the fairest indication of the position you're in as a UK employer. And if you do that in good faith, I really don't see that there can be any serious problem.
So it's really up to the employer to make a judgment call.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to see how any of these difficult questions can actually get resolved. They're just not going to be.
Yeah.
They're just always going to be there. And employers are just going to have to come up with a practical way of dealing with it and not getting too bogged down in it.
Mm. Another one that we've had queries on relates to companies with a group structure. Now, there isn't a requirement for those companies to report on a group basis, is there?
That's right, yeah. The regulations talk about having an employer. So that's the legal entity that acts as the employer, the one that actually has the contract of employment or the contract to do work.
Yeah.
So if you've got 10 different companies, each with 249 employees, then the gender pay gap regulations don't affect you.
Yeah.
I would think it's probably more effort than it's worth to actually arrange things in that way, but you know, it's not something where you're going to take a wider view of what the group as a whole employs. You've got to look at each individual employer.
But presumably where you've got various subsidiaries reporting, they're going to want to kind of report consistently in a consistent way, worth communicating with each other about how they're going about it.
I suppose that makes sense from a communications point of view.
Mm.
But I think it's a communication issue, not a legal issue.
Not a legal one, yeah. And another practical issue that could crop up is where you've got a new employee starting midway through the pay period.
Uh-huh.
So they are presumably included if...
if they're employed on the snapshot date.
Which is the 5th of April.
It's the 5th of April in the private sector. Voluntary sector, isn't it? And it's the 31st of March?
Yeah, for the public sector.
For the public sector. Yeah. So on that snapshot date, who are you employing? They're the people who should be included. We're looking at their average pay based on their normal working hours. So it's not like holidays where you have to start pro-ratering everyone's pay in order to take account of how long they've been there. The question is, who's employed on the snapshot date? And again, how bad would it be if you missed a few employees out because they hadn't shown up on payroll yet, even though they'd been employed? I wouldn't lie awake at night worrying about it.
Okay, and just looking at the format for reporting. So some people have been wondering whether or not to include more information than the minimum because the regulations only require employers to report that information. The possibility of a narrative to explain that information is very much optional. What's your take on that?
Well, I think you're right. I think to comply with the regulations, you can just publish a series of numbers that would mean very little to anybody.
Mm.
I think what employers need to think about is the extent to which they're going to be under scrutiny and the extent to which they're going to be compared to other employers, where that's something that might be potentially problematic for them. So if you're a very prominent brand, for example, it might well be that you want to explain what your gender pay gap is and what work you're doing to address that. I think if you're in the public sector, particularly if you're a local authority, you're going to be under a lot of political scrutiny as to exactly what your gender pay gap is.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of comparison between one local authority and another, potentially in the same area, who's doing best on gender pay.
Yeah.
But of course, the gender pay gap can be distorted by the extent to which an employer contracts workers out. So if you've contracted out a largely female population of cleaners or caterers, all at the lower end of the pay scale, then that's going to affect what your gender pay gap is. So if I were a local authority and I had a surprisingly large gender pay gap, I'd want to make it very clear that that's because, at least in part, I'm committed to employing people directly rather than sending them out to a contractor.
Yeah, so it's a great opportunity to put your side across where you are making positive steps, but the numbers don't really represent that.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, again, it's a communications issue, but I think it's an issue where HR has an important part to play in making it clear to the comms people as to exactly why the position is as the position is.
But much of that is going to depend on what business you're in.
Exactly.
And how much reputation is a priority. And look out for our upcoming podcast, where we'll be talking about gender pay gap reporting in the public sector. And we'll look at those provisions in detail, because there are some important differences.
There are. And I think the thing that's most important is that, realistically, if you're in the private sector, there's nothing legally that can be done if you just don't comply with these regulations. The government is trying to make out that it will be an unlawful act that the Equality Commission can do something about. I don't buy that for a moment,
to be
honest.
There's quite a lot of doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's nonsense. But if you're in the public sector, then potentially you're subject to judicial review if you don't comply with this. And it's quite possible that somebody might actually want to see your working out and will challenge the figure that you've come up with.
To going back to who you're including, things like that. That may
theoretically, in the public sector, that could be a much bigger deal than it would be in the private sector.
Mm. So if we move on to another area, which is the Trade Union Act.
Oh, yeah, proper employment law. Good stuff, this.
And something that we've spoken about before, in fact, on a podcast, but particularly timely, given that we're recording this today, Tuesday, and many of the provisions concerning balloting and strike action are coming into force tomorrow, on the 1st of March, and new requirements around picketing and the appointment of picket supervisors. So various of the main provisions are coming in tomorrow. Can you just remind our listeners of what those changes are going to mean in practice?
What we can say is on the 1st of March, the major chunk of the Trade Union Act comes into force, the big headline measures. So I think probably if I was going to pick them out, I'd say the 50% turnout requirement in industrial action ballot, the 40% support for industrial action in important public services, and extra information that has to be included on the ballot paper so that the union has to explain to some extent at least what the dispute is about. 2 weeks' notice for taking industrial action, and what's the other one? The mandate for industrial action. So instead of it being open-ended when you've had an industrial action ballot, it will only be valid for, I think it's six months.
Or 9 months.
And 9 months if you agree an extension with the employer. So those are the big chunks that are coming in from the 1st of March. I think the first thing to stress is that most of that is only going to apply for ballots that start on the 1st of March. And that's the opening day of the ballot when ballot papers are first sent out to people, which is a date that the union already has to notify to the employer as part of existing industrial action law. So anyone who's managed to get their dispute in early is covered by the old rules. But any disputes where the ballot is kicking off from the 1st of March onwards are covered by the new rules. Only really exception to that is the 2 weeks' notice for taking industrial action. So that will apply whenever you need to give notice after the 1st of March. Does that make sense?
So
if you manage to give notice today, today is the 28th, then you could take industrial action, I suppose, on the 6th. It's the maths I'm struggling with. So on the 6th of March. But if you... we're going to take industrial action anytime from the 7th onwards, you would have had to give notice of at least 2 weeks.
Of at least 2 weeks, So it's a point that people need to be aware of, because they might think the 1st of March is a date where, you know, everything that happens pre the 1st of March are covered by the old law. But there is this technical point where your notice provisions are going to change even if your strike action started before.
But to be honest, I think unions are going to be well switched on to that. And I think, in fact, the lesson of industrial action law, and this goes to what the practical impact of this is going to be, is that whenever government comes up with new hurdles for trade unions to clear when taking industrial action, what do you know, unions manage to clear them. And if they've got any sense, they turn them to their advantage. So hitherto, there's been no requirement for minimum turnout in a ballot. And so lots of industrial action ballots have had very low turnout. But I think it's a mistake to think that because we've introduced this turnout requirement, suddenly unions are going to fail to take industrial action. What they'll do is they'll be more careful about the ballots they conduct and campaigning for a proper turnout. And I suspect that a lot of people who advocated for this sort of measure, thinking that this was a way of reducing industrial action, give it a year, they'll be trying to think of what the next thing they can do is to try and limit industrial action. We've already heard some of that over Christmas when talking about potentially limiting industrial action even further in, you know, public transport and issues like that. So this is probably a subject that is going to last as long as, frankly, we've got the government that we've got.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we're still, there's still stuff coming in further down the line, isn't there? We've got changes around check-off requirements in the public sector, and also the possibility of electronic balloting, potentially.
I'll believe that when I see it. The check-off issue is interesting for the public sector. For those not familiar, we're not talking about a Russian playwright. We're talking about the way in which you deduct union subscriptions at source. The employer deducts those subscriptions. That belongs to a time when people were paid in cash and is probably seen as a little bit archaic now. The government is making it unlawful for the public sector to conduct that exercise unless the union is paying for the admin costs of doing that. And that's not coming in on 1st of March. What the government has to do is come up with some regulations defining which public sector bodies are actually covered with it. I'd imagine it'll come in sometime over the course of the summer. The electronic voting for industrial action, I'm a little bit sceptical of. The government has set up a review. Yeah. They did that in November, which I think is due to last for 6 months, looking at whether industrial action ballots can be held electronically.
Yeah.
I would be a little bit surprised if this government introduced a measure that makes it a lot easier to conduct ballots for industrial action. I'd just be, let's see what happens. Yeah. But I'm a little bit sceptical.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, as those changes come in, we'll update the site and let our listeners know what it's going to mean.
I'm just sticking with public sector employers then. We're also expecting rules around public sector exit payments to change.
Yes.
In various ways.
In various, as yet, not entirely clear ways. The government's policy is that there should be a limit of £95,000 as an exit payment for any public sector employee. So the most that can be paid out to someone who's leaving would be £95,000, which sounds like a really reasonable thing to say, because that seems like a very generous payout. I think it's way in excess of the statutory redundancy payment. But the kick is that that includes that figure, any amount that the employer has to pay in terms of pension strain, paying into the pension to allow someone to take an unreduced pension if they're made redundant over the age of, I think in local government, it's 55. And that actually is a very expensive process. And it means that that 95,000 cap will apply to a surprising range of employees who might previously have expected not only a reasonably generous redundancy payment, but also the pension that they've always believed that they would have if they were made redundant after a certain age. It's not entirely clear exactly how that's going to work, because you're going to need to change the employer's obligations under the pension scheme, and so we're waiting for final regulations. We expected this to happen last year. We expected it by about October, and it sort of didn't. We were expecting a new consultation by the end of last year, and it sort of didn't happen. So I think there still needs to be a consultation. There needs to be a new set of regulations. I think I've heard rumours that it's due in the summer, but that's what we say when we've got no idea when something's going to happen. You know, we expect something in the summer. We may find it's a long summer.
And also then there's the requirement that if that person moves jobs within the public sector, that they would have to repay it.
Yeah, that's to employees who earn £80,000 a year or more. Yeah. So any exit payment that they get, they're potentially going to have to repay if they return to the public sector, even a different public sector employer. And again, we need to see exactly how the details of that work.
We'll watch this space for
absolutely.
Now, then.
Well, let's move on then to an area where we do actually have an implementation date, and that's the 25th of May 2018. It's the General Data Protection Regulation. It's going to bring about significant change to data protection practice, and you know that's going to affect HR as far as employee data compliance is concerned. Now, I suppose people are looking at this and thinking, Europe, is it going to come in? You know, how is Brexit going to affect this? I think the view is that if Article 50 is triggered towards the end of March, and that's a 2-year process, then the 25th of May 2018 clearly falls within that 2 years.
Yep.
So we're going to see this hit in the UK, irrespective of Brexit. There will be a question mark over what happens after we leave the European Union in terms of whether or not we have to stick with it or whether the UK will choose to adopt other measures. But, you know, we're going to have to be broadly compliant in any event with European data.
Well, I think whatever the details are, the main themes of that regulation, which are all about the security of data and the transparency of the data you're holding and the access that you give it to people, exactly what our regulations are and exactly what the legislation is, those are going to be key themes that I think, when we're dealing with employee data, HR people are going to have to stay focused on.
Yeah, so it's something that HR have to apply their minds to, irrespective of the whole Brexit thing. So picking up on the key points that it covers, we're looking at processing of personal data within the EU.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the biggest changes that the GDPR may well bring in is the justification for that processing of data. I think it's fair to say that many employers at the moment rely on their employment contracts having, you know, a clause in there.
General, do you agree that we can process data about you?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that is often relied on as the justification. Now, the requirements under the GDPR are likely to be far more stringent than that. And it is going to require an audit on the part of HR and others within the business to check what provisions are currently in contracts that allow for consent. And is that going to be enough? Or are you going to have to look at the other areas in order to justify processing
under
GDPR? So it's a data audit at the moment that people are going to have to be stepping up to and looking at to say, you know, are our ducks in order for this date coming in down the line next year.
I think so, but I think irrespective of that date, it is a good idea, I think, when you're processing employee data, not to rely on the fact that the employee has given you consent. Because what if you fall out with an employee and they suddenly write to you and say, you know that consent I gave you, I now withdraw it. Do you delete their personnel record? I think the better thing to rely on, it's in the current Data Protection Act and it's in the Data Protection Regulation, is that the processing you're carrying out is for legitimate business purposes.
Yes, yeah.
And for most HR information, I think you're covered by that anyway, unless you're collecting some rather bizarre or arcane personal and intrusive data about somebody, in which case I think we should question whether that's wise or not.
Yeah.
I think if you're collecting what we would regard as normal HR data, that's covered by other provisions without consent.
Mm.
And so I think it's worth looking at the data you've got and figuring out why that's appropriate for you to be processing it.
Yeah.
You know, why it's appropriate for the business that you have for you to have this information. And whatever the detail of the regulations that eventually land on us, I think that's a good exercise to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an appropriate analysis to be doing. And, you know, in terms of the implications of the GDPR, looking at it in terms of protecting the business, we're likely to see far higher fines. I mean, at the moment, under the DPA, the current data protection legislation, it's up to £500,000 that an employer could be fined. Under the GDPR, the new regulation that's coming in, it's 4% of worldwide annual turnover or up to 20 million euros, whichever is the higher. So, you know, they're headline figures, but, you know, not to be ignored. I mean,
they're not to be ignored. But frankly, if you're ignoring the £500,000 fine, then, you know, I'd query how dedicated you are to the protection of personal data anyway. The fines are a thing that's worth bearing in mind. What you've always got to look at with data protection, I think, is risk analysis. You've got to be thinking about what is the data we're processing that people are going to be most concerned about, that is most sensitive, that is going to be most damaging if it gets into the wrong hands.
Yeah.
And the key thing to look at, the thing that will attract the high fines, is an employer being negligent about the way it secures data about employees or customers and allows that to get into the hands of people who potentially might use that for their own commercial advantage or to the detriment of the employees. And that security, again, whatever the detail of the regulations, that's an exercise that's worth doing.
Yeah, and, you know, the fine is one thing, but if you get into that situation where you have created a major breach of data and it gets out into the public domain, then, you know, you're looking at reputational risk and
it's about other fines.
You know, exactly, it's not all about the fines. But, I mean, there is an interesting change under the regulations in relation to subject access requests, purely from the point of view that I think many employers see subject access requests being used by employees potentially as a bit of a nuisance tactic, you know, or a means of trying to get through the discovery exercise that you perform in litigation at an early stage or in a more comprehensive manner. And it, you know, it can be hugely onerous to have to dig out documents from various managers and, you know, various offices and whatever for employers. So the subject access requests will stay with us, as I understand it, under new regulation. But it's now going to be a shorter period of time within which that information is going to have to be provided. We're currently within a 40-day window, it's going to shorten down to, well, within a month, possibly longer if there are exceptional circumstances for that. And there'll be no fee.
You won't even get your £10.
No, you won't even get your £10. So it's, from an employer's point of view, what has been quite often an onerous exercise isn't going to get any easier and potentially you're going to have periods that are slightly more condensed. So there will be changes that employers need to keep on top of. And I think early preparation in terms of, as you're saying, good practice, analysis and audit are only going to serve your business's interests in any event. So look at those interests with the GDPR coming into force in mind and tie them in to align. And we have got a podcast on the GDPR where we have plenty more of the specific detail of what the regulations require. And we will be updating the site and we'll also be hosting a webinar on it. So the detail will all be coming to the fore shortly.
Good stuff. There you go. Data protection is fun.
Darren, can we move on now to what was a particularly hot political topic last year and just looks set to continue to be this year, employment status and the gig economy.
Brilliant. The gig economy. You know you're in trouble when someone has thought up a catchy name for something. Suddenly it becomes the big issue that everyone talks about.
Yeah. So we've had a flurry of case law, obviously. The first and probably most high-profile one is that of Uber.
Yeah.
So just give us a kind of overview of where we are so far.
Well, in many ways, you know, nothing has really changed. And the Uber case in particular is essentially the application of the same rules that we've had in place for many years. In fact, when we're looking at the test for employment status, and we essentially go back to the 19th century in terms of case law and figuring out who an employee is, what's often difficult is we have different statuses under UK law. So we've got the idea of an employee who is someone who has a contract of service, and that goes back to very 19th century ideas of master and servant and control and things like that. We've also got what we broadly call worker status. Mm-hmm. Although slightly annoyingly, under the Equality Act, that's also called being an employee.
Yeah.
But when the Equality Act says an employee, it really means a worker because of the particular way in which the case law has gone and the way the legislation is phrased. But anyway, so a worker is someone who has a contract to perform work personally, but isn't in business on their own account to the extent that the person they're doing the work for is one of their clients or customers. Mm. And that broad test has been in place for many years, for a variety of rights, like most of the European stuff, including working time regulations, but also national minimum wage, equality, as we've said.
And national minimum wage is obviously one of the big...
And national minimum wage can be a very big one for that. And there's been a sort of arms race between employers who are trying to draft their way out of, to be cynical about it, draft their way out of some of the employment obligations they might otherwise have, and tribunals who are trying to look at the reality of the situation and look behind the contractual documentation and figure out what sort of rights it's appropriate for this particular person to have. Mm. And the Uber case is an example of that, where the tribunal's view was that the contractual documentation that stressed how very independent and in business on their own account an Uber driver was didn't accord with the reality of the case, which was that the Uber driver was working for Uber and wasn't really running their own business. Yeah. There's some question marks over that case, I think, because we have looked at cases where the worker is providing their services directly to a customer, and you could argue that the employer, in inverted commas, is merely providing access to that customer. And the particular case we think about is Quashie against Stringfellows. So it is odd that two contracts with a massive amount in common are taxi drivers and lap dancers. But that's very much, that's the way that the case law came out. And I thought the way in which Uber, the tribunal, distanced itself from the Quashie example wasn't completely convincing. It was a little bit trite. So I think maybe there's some room for challenge around that genuine sort of relationship where the employer is saying, I'm merely providing you with access to clients, because there's quite a lot of businesses, hairdressers as well, sometimes work on this basis where that's the model, and people aren't being treated as workers. So that might go a bit further. The other case we've had that's been in the news is Pimlico Plumbers, of course.
Which is the Court of Appeal.
Court of Appeal is actually a rather more standard run-of-the-mill case. I think someone who very clearly didn't have a contract of employment, he bought his own raw materials and he could make a better profit by being clever about how he bought those raw materials and the various charges he could make for them. He had an accountant. He took the full advantage of tax status of being self-employed. So I think it's quite clear he wasn't an employee. But the tribunal found he was nevertheless, or at least the Court of Appeal agreed, that he was nevertheless a worker and was entitled, I think his claim is mainly about disability discrimination. So he's in employment for the purposes of the Equality Act. I think that's a very fact-specific case, to be honest. I'm not sure it pushes the boundary. It's worth pointing out, it's not a gig economy case. True. You know, it's a straightforward, you have got this long-term arrangement, you're working for us, but you're not quite an employee, but you're nevertheless within the scope of employment.
Yeah.
I think the reason it's particularly interesting at the moment is, of course, the government conducted a review of employment status, which I think it initially thought would lead to radical changes in how we defined that. The review itself was a little bit of it seemed to be a dissertation pointing out how very complicated it all is. So, you know, I'm glad the government's caught up with how complicated this is. What we've now got is the Modern Working Practices Review, being led by, is it Matthew Taylor? From the RSA. Is it the RSA? The Royal Society of Arts. But anyway, that's obviously a very sort of open-minded think piece about the future direction of work and the regulatory framework that comes with that. So maybe something creative about employment status will emerge from that. I certainly think it's something that needs looking at, because frankly, you know, does it really make sense that we divide working people up into people who have a particular level of control and mutuality of obligation and people who don't, and we decide who gets maternity leave on the basis of that sort of distinction. It seems odd to me.
Well, we'll definitely be looking at this again throughout the year because it's bound to come up.
Okay, so moving on to a completely different area where the focus for HR is likely to be on reputational risk, and that's the recent introduction of a system where people can find out employment tribunal decisions online.
Yes.
So, you know, up till now, we've had a system which has been entirely paper-based, and you could go along to the local tribunal office at Bury St Edmunds or Glasgow if it was a Scottish tribunal.
Yeah, did you ever go to Bury St Edmunds?
I have a fair while ago now, but I have been.
It's an exciting trip. If anyone wants to go with it, you turn up to the tribunal in Bury St Edmunds. There's a public reading room that you get directed to. And last time I was there, it's basically a room full of cardboard boxes. And each cardboard box has got 250 decisions in largely random order, I think. They've got folio numbers written in biro at the top of them. And you can look at the name of the case and it tells you which box to look in. And then you flick through 250 decisions.
Yeah.
So it's not for the faint-hearted,
no.
To be honest. But if you're really keen to find a tribunal decision, you sort of can.
Yeah, and you know, obviously we've been putting up our, you know, the decisions on site for a long while now. But
you people know, didn't realise how hard it was to get hold of them. That's the key thing. Whereas now it's going to be really easy. You just do a search online.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's going to be the ease of the search that changes the whole sort of tactical approach that people will take if they want to try and find out about decisions that have been published and how that can potentially influence.
Potentially a really huge difference, actually. Mm. And it's got important implications for not just reputation, but also privacy and the duty that you might owe as an employer to employees.
Yeah.
So take an example. You can have a look on the tribunal website. You don't have to register. You just flick your way through and you can look at a random decision.
Yeah.
And in that decision, a tribunal might be expressing a view about a manager or an employee, and they might decide that the manager was incompetent or dishonest or has been lying about something. Mm-hmm. And they might say that. They might dress it up a bit. They might, you know, couch it in more sort of tactful terms. But they might come out and just say, we don't find that he was an honest witness.
Yeah.
Now, in those circumstances, that's a public record. But it's incredibly damaging for that manager personally if that gets about within the employer.
Yeah.
And what's to stop an employee from linking to the website where this decision is and sharing it with colleagues, saying, hey, everyone, look what they say about old Fred here. They say he's completely incompetent. It's difficult to see that an employer can stop that because it's a public record.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's out there and it's a, you know, it's a legitimate site to visit and, you know, people are going to be able to share that information. So I think, I mean, I was talking earlier about the tactical approach. You know, it's going to feed into how HR and those giving instructions and effectively paying the cost of settlement are going to have the discussions around, do we settle, do we litigate, do we not, because the decision's a public decision. Yeah. You know, the findings of a tribunal can be pretty damning, particularly if they're easily accessed.
I've generally been quite reticent to tell employers, oh, you should settle this case because of the reputational damage. Because I've often said, well, how realistic is it that this is going to end up on the front page of the local paper?
Yes, absolutely.
But I think the calculation does change once it becomes a public document that's available readily online. Now, of course, not all tribunal decisions are full decisions.
No.
You know, some of them are just a couple of paragraphs, and so they don't necessarily go into a lot of detail.
Yeah.
Discrimination cases are normally a full decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it may be that as an employer, you want to take advice about how this is likely to get presented. I wonder if also tribunals might be persuaded, at least in the judgments themselves, to refer to people more by initials than by name,
cool.
And that might help if it comes down to searching for somebody's name online.
I
think tribunals might be reluctant to do that because ultimately they've got to be open about who they've heard evidence from. And if there isn't a safeguarding issue or there isn't a sort of, you know, particular concern, then they may be reluctant to hide anyone's identity.
Yeah.
But they might think about not using the name quite as often as they might otherwise do so that it really shows up on search engines, for example. And this is a completely new way of thinking potentially about
these
judgments.
It is, and we'll have to see how it
evolves.
You know, it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Mm. And in the meantime, if you happen to find yourself with a spare hour, it makes for a fascinating hour of reading.
Yeah.
It's all good stuff.
So can we just look at some kind of key areas where we're seeing a lot of case law, Darren?
Uh-huh.
So first of all, just wanted to look at discrimination arising from disability.
Sure.
Because that was one of the fastest growing areas of case law in 2016. And that just looks set to continue in 2017. We're seeing a lot of, going back to tribunal decisions, We're seeing a lot of those where people succeed with their claims for discrimination arising from disability, but where they've lost their claim for failure to make reasonable adjustments. So is it easier to win a claim for discrimination arising from disability?
I think whether it's easier or harder, it is a much broader claim than I think many people have previously thought. If we think back to the introduction of the Disability Discrimination Act back in 1995, it was all really about reasonable adjustments. The actual scope of discrimination itself was really quite limited. And the Equality Act came up with this wider concept in Section 15, which has no catchy name, but is simply discrimination because of something arising in consequence of the employee's disability. And I'm not phrasing that precisely, but it's roughly that sort of thing. And that's actually a really wide concept. And it's taken a few years for people to really latch on, I think, to how wide that is. Because when you think about it, it's any unfavourable treatment that's imposed because of something which arises in consequence of disability. Now, if you take, for example, absence management, and you look at the way in which you apply your absence management procedures, that could very easily be seen as unfavourable. You might get a warning, you might get dismissed, you might get a reduction in the pay that you're receiving. What's it because of? It's because of your absence. Is your absence something that arises in consequence of your disability? Well, yes. So it's discrimination to go from full pay to half pay. It's potentially discrimination to dismiss someone for long-term absence or even to give them a warning. Now, the reason we're not all just losing cases hand over fist is there's a justification defence in this. So if the employer can show it's a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim, which is the phrase we trot out whenever we're talking about justification, then it's not going to be unlawful. But the employer has to work to show that something is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. It's not just a general reasonableness test. So in unfair dismissal, we're looking at band of reasonable responses and is the reasonable thing for the employer to do. The employer has to be a bit more precise and a bit more robust in showing why something needs to be done this way to succeed in that justification. I think a Section 15 claim is potentially a really valuable claim for people to bring. And it's something that employers need to think carefully about whenever they're doing absence management or taking any action in respect of someone who's got a disability, because establishing the groundwork for that claim is relatively straightforward.
And also disciplinary action for behaviour that may be the result of disability.
Well, I mean, we had that case, didn't we? Was it Risby?
Risby.
And against a borough council, the name of which I can't quite remember. But in that case, which I'm sure people can find on Expert HR, it was held that someone who had used racist language in responding in an angry way to an employer's insensitivity in booking a training venue, I think it was, that you didn't have access to. It was held that it was unfavourable treatment arising in because of something arising in consequence of his disability to dismiss him for using that racist language. Now, the link between the disability and racist language, frankly, wasn't there. It was really just, well, it was because he was disabled that he found himself being booked into a training course that he wasn't able to have access to, and that's what made him angry. And it was because he was angry that he went on to this tirade against somebody, and it was that that led to him using racist language. That's a very broad, you know, causal connection, I think. And if that can be potentially discrimination, then an awful lot of things can be.
It's definitely an area to be aware of, isn't it?
I think there is a justification argument in that case that perhaps the employer will manage to succeed in when it gets back to tribunal.
Yeah.
But
like
I say, they have to work hard to get there.
Well, let's take a look at another interesting case that came up recently. It's not in relation to discrimination, but it's sort of the backbone often of HR's role, which is relating to disciplinary issues. And it's the recent Court of Appeal case of Adesso Can and Sainsbury's Supermarkets.
The employee engagement survey. Yeah,
it's about an employee. Well, it was, you know, the facts of it centred on an employee engagement survey. And I think the interesting point to take from the case was the fact that there was a single act of negligence on the part of the employee in question. And that single act of negligence with an employee who I believe otherwise had a clean disciplinary record was enough to amount to justification for dismissal for gross misconduct. Now, the employee brought a breach of contract claim. It was all around the notice period and wrongful dismissal. But I think my view is that you have to be slightly cautious about it and treat it on its facts. You don't want to be jumping to a conclusion that any act of negligence is going to you know, give you grounds to dismiss for gross misconduct. What's your view, Darren, about
Yeah, I think on its facts, that's the phrase that lawyers use when we decide that something is interesting but doesn't really apply to very many other people, isn't it? So I think that's probably true with this case. There's something odd about it, I think. It seems that someone was careless about the way in which he dealt with a problem that had arisen, let's put it in those very broad terms, and he was dismissed without notice and it was held that that was okay.
Yeah.
I think certainly we shouldn't get distracted by the word negligence. I think the thing to remember about a wrongful dismissal case is that the question is whether the employee has committed a fundamental breach of contract. And whether you call that misconduct or negligence, I don't quite see why it matters one way or another. If someone is in fundamental breach of contract, they can, in contractual terms, be dismissed without notice.
Yeah.
And it was held in this case that the failure on the part of the manager was sufficiently serious that it did amount to that. But that was very much in the context of the particular engagement survey and the position it held within the company and the position he held within the company and his level of responsibility. Yeah. We certainly shouldn't seize on it as a let's sack everyone who's negligent.
No, but I think, as you say, if it goes to the heart of an employee's job and they are negligent in carrying out that function, then there may well be grounds to be able to look at it. But it will be pivotal in terms of the role that the employee performs and what they've failed to do.
Yeah, but in most employers who are dealing with this issue are going to be thinking of it from the point of view of an unfair dismissal claim.
Mm. Yes.
And this was slightly odd because for whatever reason, the employee didn't bring an unfair dismissal claim, brought a civil case alleging breach of contract. So everything is about whether he acted in fundamental breach and could therefore be dismissed without notice. And nothing was about whether the employer had behaved reasonably in deciding to dismiss him.
Yeah.
And I think realistically, most employers dealing with negligence will be thinking more about what's the fair process to go through before we dismiss somebody.
Yeah.
And frankly, the notice pay for most people, if they're not senior executives, is such a small amount that it wouldn't be the be all and end all to err on the side of dismissing with notice when someone's been negligent rather than, you know, so if it's just a poor performance dismissal, I would normally say that a poor performance dismissal, you follow the process, you have the warnings, you have the improvement program, etc. And when you dismiss with notice rather than without. Mm. And I wouldn't normally think it's worth the effort of arguing, well, their performance was so bad that we can dismiss without notice.
Yeah.
Sticking with sort of the theme of litigation, for almost 3 years now, employees haven't been able to submit an employment tribunal claim without having an early conciliation certificate. So the government hoped that early conciliation would encourage employment disputes to be resolved outside the tribunal system, thereby saving time and money. So have they achieved this?
I'm a little bit of an early conciliation sceptic. Yeah, it's an odd piece of legislation that says you have to contact ACAS before you can bring a tribunal claim. But it doesn't require you to explain to ACAS what you're contacting them about. It doesn't require you to list what it is you're upset about. And so we've had one case already, haven't we? I think it was it called Morgan? Where someone managed to rely on an early conciliation certificate that they got during a grievance process in order to bring a constructive dismissal claim that obviously didn't arise until after they decided to resign at the end of the grievance process. And it was held that that was okay because it was the same matter. It came out of the same set of circumstances. There's a lot more for the case law to look at in terms of exactly what the employee needs to be talking to ACAS about for that certificate to cover the subsequent claims. Because when you bring a tribunal claim, the normal thing to do is to have a good think about how many different things you can claim.
Yeah,
you know, and you might have a constructive dismissal claim, but you're going to think about, well, is there a whistleblowing claim we can bung in? Is there a disability discrimination, failure to make reasonable adjustments? How's the holiday pay calculation going? And you'd put that in as well. To what extent do you have to have mentioned all of those things to ACAS in order to rely on this early conciliation certificate? So I think there's all sorts of legal technicalities to come out of it.
Okay, so I think the overwhelming theme here is reputational risk, isn't it? So we've seen it through gender pay gap reporting, data protection requirements under the GDPR, worker status, employment tribunal decisions going online.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, how the extent to which the work that HR does might need to feed into the work that communications and PR do. And there's a sort of project together there that I think is worth looking at.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks very much for joining us today, Darren. That was a really helpful analysis of a range of key employment law
topics.
It's
always fun. Thanks for having me.
That those working in HR are dealing with at the moment. Now, there are obviously a number of other changes coming into force in April, which we haven't had time to talk about in this podcast.
Oh, you're going to read numbers out now?
These are the boring ones, aren't they? This is the numbers bit. So just to mention them now very briefly, we've got changes to the national minimum wage rates coming in on the 1st of April. We've got new rates of statutory maternity, paternity, adoption and shared parental pay. They're coming in on the 2nd of April. Then on the 6th of April, we've got the apprenticeship levy for large employers coming into force. Again, on the 6th of April, we are going to see an immigration skills charge for employers who employ Tier 2 migrant workers, an increase in the Tier 2 salary threshold for migrant workers to £30,000. That's from April 2017. We've got the tax-free childcare scheme that is yet to be implemented, but that was intended to come into effect in early 2017. Then we've got the introduction of a pensions advice allowance in April 2017, and also significant restrictions on the tax and national insurance advantages relating to benefits offered under salary sacrifice schemes, and they're coming into effect on the 6th of April.
That's all good fun
yes,
stuff, isn't
it? Yes, that's all good. Good, blimey. Good. Facts to remember. We've discussed all of those changes in detail and some others in our podcast that we recorded at the beginning of this year on the 2017 Employment Law Agenda. So good place to go if you want further details on those, Darren. And for changes to the statutory rates, you can also view these in our statutory rates tool. And for those of you in Scotland and Northern Ireland, do have a look at our key differences sections in the Employment Law Manual, which just summarise the differences in each legal topic there. And that brings us to the end of this week's podcast, which you've been listening to with us, Ellie Gelder, Laura Merrilees and Darren Newman. Thanks again. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.